The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. Yesterday, the Queen of England, she attempted to de-escalate the tensions between her and the royal family and Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. She released a statement last night following their 90-minute meeting with the prince, saying, "Today, my family and I had a very constructive discussion." She says she was supportive of Harry and Meghan in their desire to build a new life. But it says here, although we would have preferred them to remain full-time working members of the royal family, we respect and understand their wish to live a more independent life as a family while remaining a valued part of my family. So a diplomatic way of saying that she's pretty disappointed with the course that Harry and Meghan have set themselves on. She referred, by the way, to them as Harry and Meghan in the next paragraph of that short statement, just 150 words or so. And that just referring to them both by their first name and the statement made available to the public has some speculating that maybe she's going to prepare or rather strip them of their titles, his and her Royal Highness. So quite a few people, or the Sun, for example, accused the Queen this morning of surrendering to Harry and Meghan, but it looks like it's not quite over. It might be a little bit early to draw that conclusion. Speaking of the Sun, let me just give you some of the hard-hitting commentary from that publication. The Sun, by the way, I think has started up a U.S. publication by that same name. But it says here, "We hate to say it, but our Queen's surrender to the petulant, selfish demands of Harry and Meghan may prove the biggest mistake of her long reign." So you know where they stand. It says here, "The public will be repulsed if these two quitters continue to make a penny from them. But that's only the start. Letting them keep their titles to amass a Kardashian-sized fortune, cashing in on their royal status while will be a grotesque abuse of the monarchy and the taxpayers who fund it." The Sun says, "What will the public get in return? Nothing." So they want some of the perks and the benefits of being in the royal family, but they want to quit the responsibilities. That's what the Sun is saying there. This is what the commentator at Fox News, he's British but has since moved to the States, Steve Hilton, he said this yesterday on Fox, clip one.
"The way they've handled this has caused people such offense. First of all, because it's so disrespectful to the Queen. And whatever side you are on of the monarchy debate, whether you think Britain should be a republic or a monarchy, everyone loves and respects the Queen. And then secondly, the way that it seems they want to have their incredibly fancy royal cake and eat it. They want to have all the perks of monarchy without any of the duties and obligations. And they say they want to make their own living. How are they planning to do that? They've trademarked their royal brand, so they want that bit of the royalty, but they don't want to actually go through what they're really paid for."
That's Steve Hilton at Fox News, who went on to say that they're behaving like the liberal left. And on yesterday's program, you'll recall, if you heard that one, that they're getting career advice. Harry and Meghan, they're getting career advice from the Obamas. From the Obamas. You can go back and listen to that program on a podcast or in podcast form, if you like. Britain's Beleaguered Monarch. That's the show we posted from yesterday. One final comment here from The Sun. It says, "We never really thought this scandal could threaten the monarchy, but its image looks in mortal danger, and its finances may have to be rapidly reviewed if Harry and Meghan still receive seven-figure sums from Charles, despite having £30 million in the bank." So they're doing fairly well, and they want to go on and continue as celebrities, cashing in yet further on their royal status or their royal upbringing in his case. Switching gears here to Iran, Lee Smith just gives a wonderful overview of what led up to the JCPOA agreement from a few years ago. And I think it helps to really keep things in context when you consider the latest chapter in this ongoing saga between the United States and Iran, and of course the recent events of the Iranians surrounding and storming the embassy in Baghdad, and then of course the killing of General Soleimani a couple of weeks ago. But he says, Lee Smith does, that the JCPOA was really Obama's way of realigning U.S. interests with those of Iran. It wasn't, as they repeatedly say, well, this is meant to prevent them from getting a bomb. As we know, there were sunset clauses all through that agreement, which meant that if they just waited it out another 10 years, even if they fully complied, they still would get everything they wanted in the end, including a nuclear bomb. But Smith says that this deal, really, it was to realign the Middle East to fit within Barack Obama's worldview. It says here, for the U.S. to be able to minimize its footprint in the Middle East, the Obama White House needed a proxy force, much like the Iranians use proxies. So the Iranians, under Soleimani at the time, they had Hezbollah, they had Hamas. And to fulfill Obama's worldview, he envisioned using Soleimani as sort of a proxy force. Soleimani's Quds Force, the IRGC, to maintain stability, if you can believe it, that they even thought this way. But they really did see Iran as an ally, or one that would become an ally. They were convinced, look, let's just give them all that they want, and then we'll bribe them with huge sums of money, and they'll eventually renounce their terrorist acts and be welcomed into the international community. Those were the steps that they were taking. We were told, anyway, once the sanctions were lifted and the money was given to Iran and so on. Well, you know what it actually was. We wrote about it at the time as being the worst foreign policy blunder in American history. And really, you know, it's even worse than that. It's not really a blunder. It was all calculated. They were surrendering to the wishes of Iran. And in the end, Barack Obama gave them whatever they asked for. It was a total surrender and really a betrayal of the United States of America. Lee Smith said in 2015, when the JCPOA went into effect, Soleimani was removed from the UN sanctions list, a provision that, according to press reports at the time, the Iranians saw as non-negotiable. The Iranians said, that has to be one of the stipulations. That has to be agreed to on both sides. There is no backing away from that for us. The UN has to remove Soleimani from the sanctions list. And Lee Smith said that's the way that Obama wanted it too. He's pointed out here recently, Smith, that Soleimani was like the cornerstone of this Iran nuclear agreement. Everyone, of course, going in thought it was just about nuclear weapons. But really, it was about giving the Middle East to that man. The head of the Quds Force, the head of all these terrorist proxies, just handing the region over. It says the nuclear program, the regime's crown jewel, is controlled not by the imaginary moderates who want rapprochement from or with the great Satan. It is rather in the hands of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, and the expeditionary unit Soleimani led, the Quds Force, which have been waging war on the U.S. and its allies for 4 decades. For 4 decades. And then Smith goes on and gives some pretty compelling proof of the fact that they were working a deal with Iran straight away in the early days of the Obama administration. In fact, as we've covered on this show before, even preparing for it before coming into office. This goes back to 2008, 2009, but you had the Green Revolution, and then here's this huge uprising on the streets of Tehran, and the Obama administration sided with the mullahs. They sided with the IRGC. They sided with the Quds Force, which was gunning down ordinary Iranians in the street because they had to make a deal. They had to make a deal with the leaders of the Islamic Republic. So they didn't stand with the Iranian protesters. They stood with the radical Islamist regime. It was that way from day one, and it continued right up to the last week that Obama was in office. I'll come to that more in just a moment. But coming back to this deal, if you think about, you know, what it was preventing, even if Iran complied, it guaranteed that the Iranians would all but have a bomb within just 10 years. They just had to wait 10 years, and then it could all be done legally and out in the open, according to this deal orchestrated by Obama and his people. And all through the JCPOA, you can see the sunset clauses. There's dates in there which, okay, back in 2015, it seemed a good ways off. But here, now that we're in 2020, 2023 or 2025, that doesn't seem so far away. You see how far down the road they are. Or would have been had President Trump not intervened to rip the deal apart. Smith says the point of the deal was not to stop Iran from ever building a bomb, but to prevent the Iranians from doing so until Obama left office. See, Obama and John Kerry, that's why they were all cheering. Because they knew at least they would be out of the woods. And a worst-case scenario would be left for the next administration. He says the JCPOA advocates claim Trump left the U.S. and the entire world vulnerable by leaving the Iran deal. The JCPOA, they say, was working. This is not true and hasn't been true since the very beginning of the deal, at least not on the terms sold to Congress and the U.S. public. As you know, they lied about it. They lied about it to the U.S. public. They lied about it to Congress. They lied about it to the media and then bragged about it later. Ben Rhodes did. It says, from the start, Iran was given secret loopholes that made it appear they were meeting the publicly stated terms of the deal. And so we all were just supposed to go along with the charade. He talks in his piece about how that when Israel seized from that warehouse in Tehran, this goes back to January of 2018, they showed to the whole public later, you might remember the big pronouncement from Benjamin Netanyahu, that they hadn't in any way, Iran, they hadn't given up on their plan to build a nuclear program, a nuclear weapon. They hadn't abandoned anything. And Bibi Netanyahu revealed that to the world just 2 years ago. Well, the article, Lee Smith's article, goes through all the sunset clauses again and some of the dates. In 2023, this restriction would be lifted. This would happen in 2025. As I say, that doesn't seem far off now. You're just a few years away from it. He says here, the Iranians agreed to pretend to restrictions only because the Obama administration bribed them handsomely. We're not even talking really about a quid pro quo here. They just gave them anything that they wanted and got virtually nothing in return, except that Iran would sort of pretend to comply And yet they were breaking the rules even before Obama left office. And Obama, even during that, even during those violations, was there to make excuses for them or to bail them out. That's the history. But they pretended to comply because, well, they're getting hundreds of billions of dollars. And then he writes about the $1.7 billion. The most infamous payoff was the $1.7 billion in cash the administration shipped off to the IRGC on wooden pallets in exchange for U.S. citizens held hostage by the regime. So that was sort of a parallel tack to this agreement, that hostage exchange. Quid pro quo. Says the White House said there was no quid pro quo, that it was Iran's money to begin with, $400 million. The pre-revolutionary government had deposited in 1979 to buy U.S. arms plus interest. But the U.S. had already used the $400 million to compensate terror victims of the Islamic Republic. That was Iran's money. The $400 million the Obama administration used to pay back the Iranians belonged to the U.S. taxpayer. He says the administration argued that the U.S. had to pay the ransom in cash because Tehran had been cut off from the financial system and there was no other way to transfer the funds. Well, we had to do it with all these unmarked bills because they had been cut off from the international community and there was no way, said Obama and Ben Rhodes and others, there was no way we could have paid it to them in more official ways. Smith says that was not true. The Obama administration had wired payments to Iran before and after the wooden pallets episode. The Iranians wanted cash, so it would be harder to track their terror financing. They wanted $1.7 billion in cash because they wanted to redirect it to the IRGC, to General Soleimani. They wanted to fund their terrorist operations. But the Obama administration lied to the American people. They lied to the American public. They lied to Congress and the media. Remember, it was Ben Rhodes later, as I say, who admitted that the whole deal was constructed on top of lies. He said, we can tell journalists anything and they'll believe it. We can just tell them anything we want and they will believe it. We totally have them in our back pocket. They literally know nothing, Rhodes said, about journalists, about the media. The media, they get so offended if Donald Trump says they produce fake news. They didn't mind it at all when Ben Rhodes said they were idiots. That wasn't a threat to a free press. He said that out there in the open. What kind of media reaction did that generate? Answer, zero. Zero. They didn't care. He was an Obama spokesman. He was Obama's right-hand man. Lee Smith says, in January 2017, so this is the last month that Obama's in office, it says Obama green-lighted the shipment of 130 tons of uranium to Iran. 130 tons of it. This less than 2 weeks before President Trump's inauguration. And you can go back, you can Google the story. AP had a story on January 9th, 2017. Iran to get natural uranium batch. It says Iran is to receive a huge shipment of natural uranium from Russia. Russia, of all places. To compensate it for exporting tons of reactor coolant, diplomats say, in a move approved by the outgoing U.S. administration and other governments seeking to keep Tehran committed to a landmark nuclear pact. We've got to keep them committed to this. We've got to give them everything they want. So they'll stay in the deal. We can't have the Iranians walk away. Not an option. It says two senior diplomats said the transfer recently approved by the U.S. and five other world powers that negotiated the nuclear deal with Iran foresees a delivery of 130 tons of natural uranium. This is what Barack Obama signed off on less than 2 weeks before Donald Trump's inauguration. And you know, if you listen to this program very much, you know all about what else was happening during those weeks leading up to the inauguration with the plot against President Trump, the collusion between James Clapper and Comey and Brennan and CNN, the media, the Steele dossier. They were looking to blot out the Trump administration before it even got started. And there they were, even within days of the inauguration, shipping off 130 tons of uranium, natural uranium, to the Iranians. Getting this done before Donald Trump comes in and has anything to say about it. And here it was all orchestrated through Russia, of all places. If you look at the actions, so many of them taken during the Obama years, the swaps and so what they did to keep Iran in the deal. Russia took the heavy water and then Russia gave them the uranium. Hillary Clinton gave Russia a lot of uranium, as we well know. So many of Obama's policy achievements in the Middle East were all done via Russia. He didn't back up his red line with Syria. He just invited Russia right on in. And these are the same people that say Donald Trump is in collusion, working in collusion with Vladimir Putin. Who are the real colluders? Lee Smith here, I'm coming to the end of it. It says, if this all seems unbelievable, it's because it is. And also because you're probably still imagining that Obama's goal was to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. But once you understand the real purpose, these moves become much clearer. Why did Obama give the regime enough uranium to make 10 nuclear bombs? To pressure the incoming Trump administration to stick with the nuclear deal. See, for the longest time in the foreign policy establishment, the thinking was that, well, we can't confront Iran. We certainly can't go to battle against Iran. That would set off this apocalyptic chain of events. So we have to appease them. We have to bribe them. We have to give them what they want. And what a difficult position this puts the Trump administration in. And yet he still comes in. He leaves the JCPOA. He rips apart that deal. And then even after taking one hit after another, he finally responds. After they attempted to set off another Benghazi at the first of this year. Lee Smith says, in effect, the last president handed the Iranians a loaded gun to be pointed at his successor. On the way out, you see, Barack Obama's number one enemy was not Soleimani, it wasn't the mullahs, it wasn't the Ayatollah, it wasn't Putin, it was Donald Trump, it was the Trump administration. And here he handed the Iranians a loaded gun so that they could point it right at the successor. And as Smith explains in his article, he couldn't have pulled this off. And it's the same with the investigation into Donald Trump and the special counsel and all those things. They could not pull it off were it not for a willing and compliant press, the press corps that helped the Obama administration to deceive America. The media echo chamber, as Ben Rhodes called it. It was easy. It was easy for us to create an echo chamber. These journalists, they literally know nothing. It was so easy to dupe them. Well, as Smith says at the end of his piece, if there's one thing that we certainly know about Donald Trump, he's nothing like Barack Obama. We have witnessed a clear change in direction. Listen to how my father described this worst foreign policy deal in history. This is in a program back in September of 2015, clip 13.
But why would Soleimani say that, well, the collapse of American power in the region has happened immediately after that nuclear deal? Why would he say that? Well, it's because he sees even in those actions and even in making that nuclear deal that it was really like an American surrender. They just have collapsed. They're not asking for much of anything in return for what they're giving Iran. And they're giving Iran almost everything they ask for.
You see, worse than a blunder, as he said there, this was a surrender on the part of Barack Obama. Now, all of this, as I say, gives us some pretty important context to the ongoing attack against President Trump for standing up for U.S. interests in the region, the Middle East, for taking out the world's most notorious terrorist. And he did that, and he's being attacked. The tweet yesterday that the president sent out, he said the Democrats and fake news are trying to make terrorist Soleimani into a wonderful guy only because I did what should have been done for 20 years. See, that certainly wasn't going to be done during the Obama years because Obama was an admirer of Soleimani. He was a partner with Soleimani. He reached a deal with Soleimani. President Trump eliminated him. When we come back, we'll carry on with this again and look at the more recent events. As I say, the context here, I think, will be very helpful. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
I can reveal that I believe it would have been four embassies, and I think that probably Baghdad already started. They were really amazed that we came in with that kind of a force. We came in with very powerful force and drove them out. You know, that ended almost immediately. But Baghdad certainly would have been the lead, but I think it would have been four embassies. Could have been military bases, could have been a lot of other things too. But it was imminent, and then all of a sudden, he was gone.
That's President Trump from Friday. A few days ago, saying that it was imminent. I think four embassies were targeted. And then all over the weekend, you had his detractors, his enemies, his adversaries, parsing through all the language, comparing it word by word to everything Secretary of State Pompeo said or didn't say, and focusing in on that word imminent. Is it really imminent? How can we know? Where's the evidence? I haven't seen any evidence. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it actually was imminent. Here again, it says, it's as if the history started on what was it, January 3rd or January 2nd. On January 2nd, 2020, General Soleimani signed up at the terrorist organizations of the world and proceeded to be a terrorist. And within the next 24 hours, the president took him out. How do we know? Forget about the history. There was no history, the way the media view it. You've got to give us some evidence, Donald Trump. You've got to show us that it actually was imminent. Listen to this montage, clip three.
Let's talk about the word imminent. Do you believe it was imminent? Does not think an attack was imminent.
A little justification for an imminent threat.
Are you convinced that an attack from Soleimani was imminent?
We're not told. Any imminent threat.
An imminent threat.
Of imminent threat.
It's an imminent threat.
Imminence of the attack.
Imminent threat.
And this imminent threat.
Imminence.
Imminent.
No evidence of an imminent threat.
When they ask, do you think this was an imminent threat? What they're really saying is, we don't. We don't believe it was imminent. And so here again, the president is the one who's wrong. The president is the one who's unhinged. The president is the one who has to be contained. It's the president who has to be boxed in. The president tweeted yesterday, the fake news media and their Democrat partners are working hard to determine whether or not the future attack by terrorist Soleimani was imminent or not? And was my team in agreement? The answer to both is a strong yes, but it doesn't really matter because of his horrible past. This is a man who was planning attacks on American targets for 20 years. He wasn't taking a break when he was flying from Beirut to Damascus and then Baghdad two days. Maybe it was a day and a half after those Iranian militias finally withdrew in their attempt to besiege the U.S. Embassy. Only after Donald Trump sent in the Marines. Soleimani killed 600 Americans. 600 of them. And how many other attacks did he have in the works, even on this trip before the killing, the targeted killing? As I say, he had gone from Beirut to Damascus, then Baghdad. And when have the media ever held a president to this kind of a standard? You've got to show us the evidence. You've got to show us evidence that on Friday, January 3rd, he was planning to attack the U.S. Embassy at 10:37 a.m. that morning. If you can't show us that, then nothing was imminent. Was there an imminent strike that Osama bin Laden was planning before Obama took him out? As I recall, at the time, bin Laden was boxed in. Bin Laden couldn't even move. What about Muammar Gaddafi? We went through some of that history last week. Was he an imminent threat when Barack Obama decided in 2011, we got to take him out? We have to take this man out. This was a man that had renounced terrorism and had given up his nuclear program and was actually providing helpful assistance to U.S. intelligence agents. But Obama decided to take him out. Was there an imminent threat? Here's President Trump again from that interview with Fox on Friday, clip four.
Can you imagine they want us to call up and speak to a crooked, corrupt politician, Adam Schiff? Oh, Adam, we have somebody that we've been trying to get for a long time. We have a shot at him right now. Could we meet so that we can get your approval, Adam Schiff? And he'd say, well, let's do it in a couple of days. Oh, okay, let's meet in a couple. It doesn't work that way. Number one. Number two, they leak. Anything we give will be leaked immediately.
So here they were so upset. Congress was, some of them, mostly Democrats, a couple Republicans. You didn't give us enough detail on this attack. You should have told us everything about it. And of course, anytime that happens, the Democrats run to CNN. And then you have the media. They're upset because, in their view, there was no imminent attack. And so you see why Nancy Pelosi is coming up with these resolutions. We've got to try to hem him in. We've got to try to box the president. We've got to tie the president's hands behind his back because he's unstable. He's unpredictable. He's unhinged. Well, I went through that history with Benghazi. Obama, he just had free reign in 2011. Didn't get congressional approval. And I played that soundbite last week, Nancy Pelosi. She said he doesn't need congressional approval. He can just go in there and bomb them into a parking lot if he wants to. No need for Congress. That's what Nancy Pelosi was saying back in 2011. Listen to what the former Attorney General, this is Barack Obama's wingman, Eric Holder. He gave a speech at Northwestern University in March of 2012. And listen to what he says about an imminent threat. Clip 5.
The evaluation of whether an individual presents an imminent threat incorporates considerations of the relevant window of opportunity to act, the possible harm that missing the window would cause to civilians, and the likelihood of heading off future disastrous attacks against the United States. As we learned on 9/11, Al-Qaeda has demonstrated the ability to strike with little or no notice and to cause devastating casualties. Its leaders are continually planning attacks against the United States, and they do not behave like a traditional military, wearing uniforms, carrying arms openly, or massing forces in preparation for an attack. Given these facts, the Constitution does not require the president to delay action until some theoretical end stage of planning when the precise time, place, and manner of an attack become clear. Such a requirement would create an unacceptably high risk that our efforts would fail and that Americans would be killed.
Well, how about that? That's the Attorney General for Barack Obama saying that you can't tie the president's hands behind his back. What if he only has a short window of an opportunity here? And it's not like Al-Qaeda. They've been demonstrating over the course of years that they strike without any notice. Soleimani does the same thing. And now, well, you heard the media montage. Imminent, 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 imminent. It's like a broken record. These are not honest. These are not honest journalists. They're agenda driven. I happen to agree with Ben Rhodes. How much do they really know? How much do they understand this history? This is from 8 years ago. Are they really concerned about America's welfare and being well-being? Are they concerned about informing the public? Obama's wingman, he was out there giving speeches like this because he was called upon to defend the hundreds of drone strikes that were authorized by Barack Obama. Donald Trump's adversaries would have us believe that, as I say, unless Soleimani has some kind of notarized slip indicating that he's about to attack, and we discover it, and then we run to Congress, that there is no authorization for a U.S. president to take action. Listen to more of what Eric Holder said in 2012, clip 6.
The conduct and management of national security operations are core functions of the executive branch, as courts have recognized throughout our history. Military and civilian officials must often make real-time decisions that balance the need to act, the existence of alternative options, the possibility of collateral damage and other judgments, all of which depend on expertise and immediate access to information that only the executive branch may possess in real time.
See, the executive needs some authority if he's going to carry out his job, his responsibilities as the commander in chief. And that's exactly what President Trump was saying last week on Fox. We had a window of an opportunity. We didn't want to tell Congress all the details because there's too much of a chance it'll be leaked, that my enemies will run to CNN to try to stop it, to try to stop me. That was from Eric Holder's speech in 2012. This article at The Atlantic from 2016, it elaborates on President Obama's record of drone killings. It says the strike, well, it's picking it up in the middle of a thought about this one drone strike, how it missed its target, and Newsweek reported that Obama was made aware almost immediately that innocents died in the attack. It says by the end of 2009, this is in Obama's first year as president, the CIA had already conducted its 100th drone strike in Pakistan. 100 drone strikes, 100 targeted killings. Barack Obama was the drone strike king. It says here, later, a whistleblower provided The Intercept with a cache of documents detailing the U.S. military's drone killings in Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia. So you've got Pakistan, you've got Somalia, Yemen, Afghanistan. You've got just about every nation in the region, except Iran. Don't want to touch anyone with Soleimani's group. It says one campaign, Operation Haymaker, took place in northeastern Afghanistan. It says between January 2012 and February 2013, U.S. Special Operations airstrikes killed more than 200 people. Of those, only 35 were the intended targets. They were aiming for 35 people. And the collateral damage took down a total of 200. During 1 5-month period of the operation, according to the documents, nearly 90% of the people killed in airstrikes were not the intended targets. This is the drone strike king, who also happened to be, well, he was off target quite a lot. He missed his mark, which you can't exactly say President Trump did on the early morning hours of January 3rd. He hit the two vehicles, took out all the terrorists, and that was that. 90%. That just tells you that he was willing to send in missiles, to send in a strike to populated areas. Can you imagine? What if you see the fuss that this has caused just by taking out the world's number one terrorist? What if there would have been 70 or 80 civilians that died as a result of this strike? Oh, that happened routinely with Barack Obama. 90% of the casualties were civilians. He had fired 100 drone strikes in his first year in office. Listen again to Eric Holder from 2012, clip 7.
Furthermore, it is entirely lawful under both United States law and applicable law of war principles to target specific senior operational leaders of Al-Qaeda and associated forces. This is not a novel concept. In fact, during World War II, the United States tracked the plane of Flying Admiral Osoroku Yamamoto, the commander of Japanese forces in the attack on Pearl Harbor and the Battle of Midway, and shot it down specifically because he was on board that plane. As I explained to the Senate Judiciary Committee following the operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the same rules apply today.
But not to this day. They applied up until 2012, 2013, even all the way through to the early weeks of 2017, but they don't apply to today. They don't apply to this administration. It's different now. Forget about Yamamoto. Forget about Osama bin Laden. There was no imminent threat. And forget about the 20-year track record of Soleimani. We've just got to boil it down to imminent. Imminent, imminent, imminent. The former attorney general, he went on to say this, clip 8.
Now, some have called such operations assassinations. They are not. And the use of that loaded term is misplaced. Assassinations are unlawful killings. Here, for the reasons that I have given, the U.S. government's use of lethal force in self-defense against a leader of Al-Qaeda or an associated force who presents an imminent threat of violent attack would not be unlawful and therefore would not violate the executive order banning assassination or criminal statutes.
It's not an assassination at all, said Eric Holder. And yet, what did we hear over and again in those days following the killing of Soleimani? Here's clip 9.
And I don't think you're an assassin. Okay. Anyway, thank you so much. This president is.
So once you're in the business of assassination.
This assassination.
Assassinated.
But that's nothing compared to the murder or the assassination.
President Trump recklessly assassinated.
It sounds like it's more like an assassination.
To the assassination of Qasem Soleimani.
Wasn't it an assassination? And if so, do you think that's a war crime?
It was an assassination.
He was a commanding general of a sovereign foreign nation, and we executed him. So I don't think you can call it anything other than an assassination.
Of course, it's not just an assassination. It's a murder. He's guilty of war crimes. What did the attorney general say? Some have called such operations assassinations. They are not. And the use of that loaded term is misplaced. Until 2013, the drone strike king, all of the targets were foreigners, foreign enemies, foreign terrorists. But then he came to 2013 and he was presented with a pretty big constitutional problem because one of his drone strikes took out a terrorist on foreign soil, and that terrorist happened to be an American citizen. This was the case of Anwar al-Awlaki. He's a Muslim cleric, a terrorist background, but an American citizen that was killed in Yemen. So let's see, we're counting Yemen, Afghanistan, Somalia, Pakistan, drone strikes all over the place. And when one took out an American citizen, there was a little bit of a protest in Congress and some few in the media, mostly the conservative media, that thought, well, hang on a second. What about that American citizen's due process? What about his right to a fair trial? Here's how the Obama Attorney General, Eric Holder, explained that. Clip 10.
Some have argued that the president is required to get permission from a federal court before taking action against a United States citizen who is a senior operational leader of Al-Qaeda or associated forces. This is simply not accurate.
Don't need to go to Congress. Don't need to get anything from a federal court. Nothing should slow Barack Obama down. Even if the terrorist happens to be an American, take him out. And so he did. He took him out. He took out his 16-year-old son in the same strike. No problemo. You might remember that section in America Under Attack. My father talks about the drone strikes. And he explains how that Obama had launched. He's writing this in 2013. And he explains how Obama launched 5 times more drone strikes than President Bush. And he was only halfway through his eight-year presidency. We should have gotten a final tally on that for his 8 years. Hundreds and hundreds of drone strikes. 90% of the casualties, civilians. My father in that booklet quoted Judge Andrew Napolitano from Fox News. Or I guess he wrote an article in the Washington Times that says, Mr. Obama has argued that he can kill Americans whose deaths he believes will keep us all safer without any due process whatsoever. No law authorizes that. His attorney general has argued that the president's careful consideration of each target and the narrow use of deadly force are an adequate and constitutional substitute for due process. No court has ever approved that. That's not constitutional. Now, as my father says in America Under Attack, it may be that these, at least with the father, what can we say about the 16-year-old son, however? But the father was undoubtedly a bad guy. But here was a case where the U.S. president actually did go around the constitutional requirements in order to carry out his objectives. One last one here from Attorney General Eric Holder. This is clip 11.
The Constitution's guarantee of due process is ironclad, and it is essential. But as a recent court decision makes clear, it does not require judicial approval before the president may use force abroad against a senior operational leader of a foreign terrorist organization with which the United States is at war, even if that individual happens to be a U.S. citizen.
Even if it's a U.S. citizen. You see how it works here? Barack Obama can take out any terrorist with a drone strike. He can take out a lot of civilians. He can take out a 16-year-old teenager who also, by the way, was an American citizen. No need for a trial. No due process. Nothing. Donald Trump eliminates an Iranian mass murderer, and it's Donald Trump. Certainly not Soleimani. It's Donald Trump who's pure evil. In 2013, we wrote at the Trumpet about the Obama administration confirmed this killing of four American citizens. Drone strikes had taken out four of them. Holder, Eric Holder, acknowledged that the government had ordered a specific attack on one American while three others were killed in strikes but were not specifically targeted. They weren't even targeted and they were killed. Barack Obama killed three Americans as he was out there trying to blow up terrorists. And you probably never, ever even heard a peep of this from the major media. Do they really have America's best interests at heart? Are they really trying to educate and to inform the American public? This is all part of Barack Obama's secret wars. And the media today, they go overboard to keep this, to carefully conceal this from you. In the Boston Herald last week, it says here, yet during the Obama years, they turned a blind eye. He's talking about the media and this double standard, this hypocrisy. During the Obama years, they turned a blind eye to the hundreds of drone strikes by the former White House administration in Pakistan, Somalia, and beyond that took out terrorists and dozens of innocent civilians alike. The New York Times editorial board reported last March the Obama administration estimated that over its two terms, drone strikes had killed between 64 and 116 civilians in 542 airstrikes outside the major war zones. Other experts calculated the civilian death toll closer to 324. 324. It's pretty amazing. Just a little bit of recent history. But are we being educated in this very, very recent history? Judging by what they're saying on college campuses, the answer would be no. This is a little montage from campus reform. Georgetown students reacting to Soleimani's killing, clip 12.
So do you think it was based on racism in a degree?
Oh, I 100%. I think that most decisions that the United States government makes are based on their allegiance to white supremacy and white supremacist issues.
So I'm one of the few Shia Muslims on this campus. So it was a little bit devastating for me. To be honest with you, to be very frank, like, my family was, like, devastated. Like, I went to my mosque that day for Friday prayer, and they were, like, mourning the death of him as, like, a martyr.
I was shocked and kind of then after that immediately disgusted that Trump had done that. Don't have the moral authority, and certainly Trump himself doesn't have the ability to do that.
I certainly feel for the Iranian people.
It was such a big official that it meant a lot to a lot of people, so to kill someone like that so brutally all of a sudden, obviously it's something that hurts.
What I've been hearing in, like, my mosque and amongst my family is that, like, he was someone that stood up for the oppressed. The oppressed in this case are, like, largely, like, the Shia Muslims.
There's a lot of, like, sentimental feelings going on, and I want to be able to, like, empathize with that, and I think it's definitely, like, something to empathize about.
So the United States is not, like, innocent. I mean, really, Western imperialism, you can see the impacts of that in a lot of other nations in a lot of different ways.
I think no matter what you do,
No matter how, like, all the crimes you can commit, you still deserve the right to a trial. I don't think that just applies to Americans.
That's that last one there. He's calling for due process for Qassem Soleimani. No due process for the American jihadist or his 16-year-old son. But we definitely should give due process to the world's leading terrorist. This is a college student, a U.S. college student who thinks that an Iranian terrorist, the world's most notorious terrorist, should have been protected by the U.S. Constitution. Think about that. This is education today. Soleimani denied the rights of 600 Americans to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. And yet here are college students today saying that we should have protected his rights to go right on killing Americans. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email feedback, send it to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.